about how to synthesize programs, how to make it easier for programmers to develop programs in their everyday practice, and how this relates to programming languages and their implementation will become clearer as we go. But at the highest level, essentially, if you want to synthesize something, you need to describe what you want to synthesize in some language, and you need to have some algorithms underneath that will take that description and synthesize it. And so that description is a language, and that stuff underneath, the synthesizer, is the implementation. So that's the relationship. And so there will be three lectures, and today I'll try to cover some sort of overview of how programmers may want to synthesize stuff. And essentially, it's about communicating the insight about what they want to synthesize, what they know about the problem, and what they want the synthesizer to come up with, how that is communicated to the synthesizer. Then I'll show you a little bit at the end of how we do it in our project, which we call sketching. It's a particular way of describing what you want to synthesize. Tomorrow we'll talk about algorithms for synthesis, which is how you actually turn that description into the resulting programs. And on Saturday I'll talk about some work that we have ongoing in our group on using angelic non-determinism to hopefully make it easier for programmers to program. So this will be more open-ended and hopefully open for discussions, for your suggestions, ideas. And a demo hopefully will be included on Saturday. Okay, so today about how do we make programmers communicate with the synthesizer? The idea that when the programmer develops program, he or she talks to the synthesizer or to some tool that really understands what the programmer is doing is not new. In fact, about 30 years ago, in the 70s, there was this really nice project, Programmer's Apprentice at MIT, which proposed this idea that the programmer will not just develop the program, compile it, debug it, but instead there will be this semantically rich tool underneath. So let's see how they envisioned the scenario. So the programmer would start by describing the specification of what he or she wants to implement. So essentially, if he wants to do a hash table-based set, this is not what I want. Then what he would do is specify the specification, which is, well, the result of the delete is that you take the set S and then remove from it all elements that you want to delete. So the result is a set with all the elements we deleted from it. And that's your declarative specification. And given that, then he tells the apprentice that, well, I have this high-level plan of how I want to implement it. And the plan essentially has three steps. You hash the input key to get the index, then you fetch the bucket in the hash table that corresponds to this index, and finally you splice out all the entries in that bucket whose key is equal to that input key V. And the apprentice comes back and says, well, I'm sorry, but that won't work. Essentially, the apprentice spotted a bug in this high-level implementation. They call it a plan, but really you could think of it as the inside, the idea of how the programmer wants to implement it. And what is important is that the apprentice here would give a scenario in which that specification would be broken. Essentially, it would give a scenario under which the plan would not meet the specification because there would be a bug. And in this case, the bug would be that if you are splicing out an element from the head of the list rather than somewhere in the middle or at the end, there would be a bug. So this is what the apprentice would do. So the programmer then would fix the plan or call it inside or high-level program. And then he would also give this low-level code. So unlike the high-level plan, this is the code here in Lisp notation, but it doesn't matter, something low-level and executable, and give it to the apprentice. And the apprentice would say, well, again, I'm sorry, but this is not consistent with the plan. So now the apprentice supposedly is able to check that the implementation meets the high-level plan. And it gives you, again, a description of the bug, and it suggests a correction. Programmer says, well, if you are so smart, why don't you fix the code? And the apprentice does, and here it is. So why are we talking about it? Because this was the vision 30 years ago of how the programmer would actually communicate with a tool. So is this reality? If it is not reality, probably we should sober up and forget synthesis and just focus on better languages, better compilers. And if some of it actually happened, it probably makes sense to push it further, even if it takes another 30 years to make it reality. So what is it that we can already do? So today we can essentially do the following. We can check implementations like these against specifications. We can find errors of that sort. And we can also give descriptions of when that error happens by means, say, of an execution trace that demonstrates there is an error. And in some cases, we can also suggest that there is a correction that you could make. And so these are not things that are on the shelf, and you cannot probably download them and use them in a robust way, but there are papers that demonstrate how to do it. We cannot yet do this. We cannot still communicate at this high level of abstraction. But that perhaps is just a question of realizing that languages like Python, Scheme, and Ruby are important for programmers, because this is essentially what it is, a description in some high-level language. Once we realize that the correctness of these programs is actually important, perhaps the research will move from these low-level checks to these high-level checks. So that seems doable. So how could we make these tools reality, move them to programmer practice? So that's essentially the what I want to talk about today and the next 2 days. So to see what tools are at our disposal, we want to look at what program synthesis is available. So program synthesis itself is about 30, 40, maybe longer around. And it makes sense to look at what people have tried. So there are roughly 3 ways how you can divide it. The first one is the deductive. Essentially, it uses theorem proving for deriving the programs. Then there is transformational, which takes a program and through a sequence of transformation derives an optimized program. And then there is what you could call inductive. So rather than deriving it from a specification, you give it a few examples. These could be inputs or executions, and from those it will try to generalize into the program that the programmer has in mind. I'll tell you more about these, but before we got into it, let's say that these really are derivative in the sense that they start from some specification, what you want to do, and in a sequence of steps they derive the program that the programmer wants. And this one is in the sense that somehow you describe a space of programs, not all of them necessarily correct or implementing the specification, and then somehow you pick from that space the program that you want. So this is more about selecting one that is correct versus deriving it. So what is this derivative synthesis? So this is essentially a process of searching for a derivation that from some starting point, usually describing what you want, produces a program. So theorem proving clearly is a process for looking for such a derivation, except in theorem proving, you're looking for a proof of a theorem. But there is a close connection. In fact, the deductive synthesis works as follows. Your program specification is a theorem, essentially claiming, given an input array, there exists a sorted version of this array. And showing that, yes, indeed, there exists a sorted version of the array, you obtain a proof. And a byproduct of obtaining a proof is also a program that does the sorting. So proving the existence that there is a way how to get that result is also a program that computes that result. So you can prove that, yeah, there exists a way of sorting an array, you also get a program for sorting. So the program is a byproduct of that proof. Transformational is a little bit like optimizing compiler in the sense that you start a program that is a reference specification, probably slow, but very clear. And then you start transforming it in various ways. You can think of it as you start looking for alternative implementations of the program, perhaps in a divide and conquer fashion, that you want to sort an array of 1,000 elements. Then you realize, oh, I can break it down in a particular way into sorting of 2 500 element arrays. And then you do this decomposition until you come to small problems which you can solve efficiently. And then how you did this decomposition really gives you the performance of the overall algorithm. And you can really think of it as you are looking for alternative implementations, not only of that upper level specification, but at each level of that decomposition. And so there are really successful things. FFTW is a system, as well as Spiral, for creating high performance implementations of linear filters, such as FFTs, DCT, and so on. Some that humans cannot generate, because you generate a program that may be thousands of lines of code, if not more. But they are by search tuned really well to cache performance, parallelism, and such. And KIDS is a system based on theorem proving that was able to generate really efficient schedulers, schedulers for things like moving troops, tanks, and things on a bounded number of ships and airplanes across the continents. So this all sounds good. And in fact, derivative synthesis is extremely powerful. But there is one problem. If you want to give it to the hands of programmers, you would need to teach the programmers how to develop what you could call a domain theory. The domain theory is essentially how the programmers communicate the insight about the domain to the synthesizer. And that domain theory must say enough to enable the derivation of those programs. So if you want to implement FFTs really efficiently, you need to somehow describe the transformations that can take an FFT of 1,000 and break it down into smaller ones in many different possible ways. And that usually requires formal education, expertise, and time. And so that has historically been limited to experts. So to give you an example of what these domain theory fragments may look like for Spiral, here is an encoding of the Cooley-Tukey algorithm for FFT. And essentially what it does, it says, well, let's take an FFT, discrete FFT of size 4, and you can decompose it into two FFTs of size 2. If you appropriately decompose it, you do a transpose, you do an LVJ, I don't remember what it is, but you get the idea of how you describe the decomposition steps. And then the implementation of the FFT is essentially a sequence of such decompositions. You take this FFT of 4, break it down into these you can decompose further, and you obtain this huge tree. And of course, depending on the sequence of these decompositions, you get different algorithm with different performance characteristics. In KIDS, which is this deductive approach, you may specify the following lemma, which essentially encodes a divide and conquer approach to algorithms. Essentially, what you say is this. If you want to compute something described by this predicate, what does this predicate say? That the computation is correct if on input x0, you get the output z0, and this pair of values meet some predicate. Perhaps z0 is a sorted version of x0, so this O would encode the predicate sortedness. And how can you get it? Well, you can get it by first decomposing x0 into x1 and x2, then at the end, then what do you do? Then you recursively solve the smaller version, x1 and x2, and then you somehow need to be able to compose z1 and z2 back into z0. So if you look at sorting algorithms, then the merge sort may be a particular way of breaking x0, splitting it in half, sorting recursively, and then composition will be taking these two half-sorted arrays, and in an appropriate way, you would merge them into z0 by picking always the highest element from the top of the two sorted arrays. And so how would deductive synthesis work? Well, you could probably specify a decomposition, and then with the theorem prover, you would show what must be the property of the composition relation. You would essentially say, okay, I can indeed sort it given the decomposition that the programmer specified if the composition does the following thing. And by doing that, you have proven the sort of precondition, postcondition, what must be true about the composition, and by doing that, you figure out what that composition function must be, and effectively you have synthesized it. But you are working at the level of such lemmas, and it's hard to believe that the programmers could implement, say, merge sort faster by working this way rather than in the usual way. So this is perfect if you want to create something complicated for which you want to have a proof that it is correct. Probably not the best way if you want to improve programmer productivity. So that's why we want to look at selective synthesis, which is the approach where somehow you describe a space of candidate implementations. So these are programs that the programmer considers to be, well, that the synthesizer should consider for the programmer. Hopefully in that space is the program that the programmer wants. And the task is, of course, to find the one that meets the specification. And how to do it? Well, one simple way is, of course, use a tester or a verifier. For this talk, let's assume that it's a black box that is available to you. And you go through these elements of that space, perhaps one by one, and you test each of them against that specification using the tester or a verifier. You give appropriately strong or weak correctness guarantees. And eventually, you arrive at the program that is what the programmer wants, and you are done. Of course, such search is not really scalable, so there are better ways how to do it. But this, in principle, is the idea. So the benefit is that you don't need a domain theory, and therefore there is no need to specify things formally, the rules for derivation, because you are not doing any derivation. And of course, there is a domain theory embedded in that tester or verifier, right? The verifier, in order to verify this program, needs to somehow know how to verify these things. But if you are happy with the tester or a model checker, then there is no such need for domain theory at all, except perhaps for scalability, and we get to it tomorrow. So clearly, this process is less efficient in general because you are not you know, in derivative synthesis, whatever you derive is always a correct, semantically correct version of that specification, because each of these rewrite rules is typically semantically preserving. It's not always like that, but at the highest level it is true. Here we really are looking through a bunch of programs, most of them are incorrect, and we are looking for one that is correct. So therefore, there is much more searching to do, and how to do it efficiently is the sort of algorithmic question that we'll tackle tomorrow. If you do it naively, and indeed there are programs called super optimizers that try to generate optimized sequences of instructions. Essentially, you give it a small C program that implements some simple functionality, one that you believe can be implemented with a sequence of, say, RISC instructions, and the super optimizer generates all candidate sequences, checking with a tester, or you can use a verifier, whether it does indeed implement the equivalent C program. And that works, but only about the sequence of 6 instructions. After that, the exponential blow-up is so large that it's infeasible. So you clearly see that searching a space naively won't get you really far. So I'll show you how you can do it better. So the title of the talk is algorithmic synthesis, which tries to mean that you don't really need to develop your domain theory and in an interactive fashion prove things, but instead you do something relatively naive and the computer does that search for you, and so in that sense it's automatic or algorithmic. So instead of deriving, we want to search a space of candidate programs, and this is sort of like model checking, where in model checking you look for bugs in your program or you want to prove the correctness in some way, but essentially the executing the program on all possible inputs, what are you doing? You're searching a space of executions of the program, checking that no bad things happen in that space. So here we are doing something similar, except we are searching not the space of executions, but the space of alternative implementations, looking for one that is correct, according to some spec. So that's the connection here. And in order to do it, again, you need just a checker. And the checker, by the way, could itself be a model checker. So each time you check a program, you want to search a space of its executions. So in a sense, it's just an outer loop around the model checker, where the outer loop does the search over space of implementations. So we essentially talked about that. Okay. So when it comes to this, this is all about how you communicate the insight to the synthesizer. There are, of course, these scalability problems that boil down to algorithms, but if you want to improve programmer productivity, it's really about how the programmer describes what he wants to synthesize, how you capture that insight. And this will summarize the comparison with derivative synthesis. So in derivative synthesis, you have a spec. Then you have the domain theory, which could be axioms, theorems, rewrite rules. And from those, you find a suitable sequence that will get you to an implementation. In the process, you may get stuck and get to a point from which you cannot rewrite and you backtrack. But this is essentially how the resulting program is obtained. In the synthesis from the selective one, where you have a space of programs, you can think of it as synthesis of partial programs. A partial program is a program that has holes in it. Right? These are the things that you need to complete. And by completing these holes, you are effectively picking a particular candidate from the space of programs. So the space of programs is described by the partial program with holes. Think of them as parameters that parameterize this program. I'll show you many more examples of how, many real examples of how this could look like. But the idea of doing the synthesis is that you look through a space of this implementation described by the partial program, essentially by trying all completions one by one, until you get to an implementation. And how you do it is by using some automatic validation, testing, verification to see that this indeed behaves like the spec. So in derivative synthesis, essentially we have insight in domain theory or no insight on the selective side. This is more efficient, less efficient. We'll go with the selective in this talk because it gives us more accessibility to the programmer, we believe. And the key question is how the programmer can actually communicate the insight such that that candidate space is small enough that you can effectively search it. So with that, I want to go through 5 systems based on the idea of partial programs. Some of the creators of the systems, including us, didn't realize that it was all based on partial programs, but sort of over the years, people figure out that the essential idea is the same. And I want to compare them and show that the insight can take various forms. And at the end, you will start thinking in terms of partial programs too. And as you think of programmer problems in the future, the idea of partial programs and insight may come to you just because the connections will be clear now. We'll see how the insight is communicated with partial programs, and also we'll talk about where the specification of correctness comes from, because that's important too. Without knowing what you want to specify, you cannot run that synthesis, because there needs to be always a reference implementation of some sort. So the first system on partial programs that we know of is probably A-Lisp. Essentially stands for Agent Lisp. And what they do, they try to solve the problem of implementing AI game opponents. So essentially, this is a problem of using AI and machine learning to implement intelligent agents. And machine learning itself can, in principle, implement some such agents. So these will be the opponents in the computer game that you play, except that the state explosion in machine learning prevents you from applying machine learning out of the box. These agents have complicated behavior, and the current algorithms cannot solve. In contrast, you could use programmers to implement these agents, but when they do, after months of implementations, they still implement something vastly inferior to an experienced human player for the game. So their idea was, well, could you somehow combine machine learning with the expertise of the programmer? And the way of combining machine learning and programming is that the programmer supplies a skeleton of the intelligent agent. And in that, the programmer provides essentially a strategy for that agent to play the game. And machine learning fills in the details based on reward function. And how they do it, they use hierarchical reinforcement learning. And maybe we'll have time to talk about it, or maybe not. This is not essentially important here, because today I want to highlight what is inside and how to communicate it. What are partial programs? So what do you encode in the partial program? So presumably, we encode something that is really hard for the machine learning algorithm to come up with, but something that is absolutely obvious to the programmer, or at least easy to state. So in this game, there are the following strategic decisions, which you could say as the high-level outline of what the agent should do. So in that game, essentially, it's a game where you collect resources, gold, wood, you build armies, then you attack the opponents, you get the idea. The strategy may be, well, you first train a few peasants, then you send them to collect the resources once they are trained, and this will be wood and gold, and you need to decide which of them. When you have enough wood, you reassign the peasants to build barracks. When barracks are done, you start training footmen because you have a place to house them. And then you probably at some point you are ready to attack, but you decide, well, it's not good to attack alone, but instead you want to attack with a group of footmen, because this way the attack is likely to be more successful. So this is what the programmer knows, and this is what would be nice to encode in the partial program and have the machine learning algorithm figure out how exactly the decisions are made. So how many peasants do you need to train first? How much wood do you need? How much gold do you need? How big should the groups be for attack? And that essentially gives you the idea of a partial program. And here is the partial program that in A-Lisp. The syntax is not so important, but the idea is. So essentially, here they have the outer loop for training a single peasant. And what do? You loop, and in each iteration, you need to decide. And here is essentially the hole in the program, in that partial program, which will be filled in by the machine learning an appropriate decision function. That will be a function of the entire environment, of the position of your army, your position army, how many resources you have. But that function will go there. It will replace this choose. And what choices you have? Well, you either get gold, so you invoke the action go and get gold, or invoke the action go and get wood. How to decide? The programmer doesn't know, but machine learning will figure out. In get wood, well, first you navigate to some of the forests, and you need to choose the forest. And which forest you choose presumably depends on the proximity of the forest, whether the forest still has any wood left, and so on. Then, after you are done, you navigate home. And how do you navigate? Well, you loop until you are at the desired position. And in each step, you need to choose whether you go north, south, east, or west. And that presumably depends on what is your position relative to the destination. So here are the three holes that are learned. And here is an example of a function that you learn in order to do navigation. So perhaps you compare the x-coordinate of you with the x-coordinate of the desired destination. If you are to the right of it, then you need to go west. And there will be some other checks here which will check for conflicts, meaning you would not navigate into a position where there is somebody already standing and so on. But this is roughly what the synthesizer does and plugs it into the program. So this is a Lisp. The Sketch is a system that we've been working on for a few years. And after initial explorations, we got stuck. And then we heard about a Lisp and the idea that you can describe pretty much any program by just leaving holes and have the synthesizer fill in allowed us to move the research much faster. And I want to give you an example of the sort of synthesis we do. So first, the problem that we attack. So in contrast with A-Lisp, we don't want to train intelligent agents. We want to make it easier for you to implement an algorithm. So the problem really is that when you have a 10-line algorithm, sometimes to turn it into an executable program, you need to blow it up 100 times, going from pseudocode to low-level code. The reason is various. Often the pseudocode is a high level. It talks about sets, but you need to implement the sets in a particular way to get performance. Often the corner cases are not specified in the pseudocode, but you need to flesh them out as you run the algorithm. And so that's essentially the idea. You're probably very familiar with it. So that was our motivation. And we were especially interested in low-level, high-performance computing for crypto, parallelism, and so on. So again, there is a partial program. We call it a sketch. So the programmer sketches the implementation. So this is, again, a template that conveys the insight. Of course, the programmer supplies also a reference implementation, so slow, trusted version of the same behavior, so not parallel but sequential. And there is a set-based inductive synthesizer, which I'll describe tomorrow. So let me give you an example. It comes from concurrent data structures. These are data structures that are accessed simultaneously by multiple threads. So that data structure here is a linked list that has a list of nodes. They are sorted by the key. So here are the keys. They are sorted. They have sentinel nodes so that the corner cases are simplified so that the list is never empty. There are these two sentinel nodes. And that's it. And you want to implement the concurrent remove method. So let's first see what that method would do in the sequential remove, meaning no concurrency, a single thread. So you walk through the list. You go here, here. Then you find C, which you want to remove. And you remove it by flipping that pointer. And then the garbage collector just removes that C, and you are done. Now, to do it concurrently, you can either log the whole list, of course, and then it's simple. But if you want to get performance, you want to do a little bit more fine-grained locking. You want, in particular, multiple threads to walk through the list simultaneously so that they can both advance through that list. So the insight you could say that the programmer has for implementing the concurrent remove has two parts. First, for efficiency, we use fine-grained locking rather than log the entire list at once. So you want to log individual nodes. And the second one is that, well, it's not enough to log one node at a time. Because if each thread holds only one node, it could be that the threads sort of can get ahead of each other. And that could lead to removals that are incorrect in the sense that you remove something, but then it later appears in the list. And how actually the programmer can get the second insight? Well, it will soon be obvious how it can get the insight with our synthesizer. But let's assume he already understands that you need to be locking two nodes at a time, otherwise the threads could corrupt each other's behavior. So here is roughly how you need to do it. You have two locks, and you grab one lock, and then before you release it, you need to grab the next one, then you release that one, and you walk the list like this. And so this is still just an insight. How to actually implement it, in which order to grab the logs, which fields to log, is the mechanics that you would say the synthesizer should be much better at figuring out. So here is how we envision the programmers will sketch it. So here is a remove method, essentially sequential version. You'll see what it does. You want to remove this node with this key. You remember the current pointer, which points initially to the head. You remember two other pointers, previous and another previous, which remember essentially three sliding pointers through the window. You are not sure at this point whether you need all three of them. Maybe two is enough, but you put it into the sketch just so that the synthesizer has more freedom. In each iteration, you advance the pointers in the usual way. Remember, this is a sequential version. You check whether you reach the key or not. Remember, the keys are sorted. And at the end, after the loop, you check whether you found it. If you have, you flip the pointer like this. This is the sequential version. Now, what do you do to turn it into a sketch for a concurrent one? Well, the first thing the programmer believes is true is that, well, before you go into the loop, you need to log something. But he or she doesn't know exactly what to log. So he will say, Well, I want to log some either the current node or the node that current points to through next. So either log current or current.next. And what you see here are essentially our constructs to communicate with the synthesizer. This is essentially a regular expression here which says the synthesizer must here choose either current or optionally .next, and it must choose it in such a way that the whole thing is correct. Now, at the end of the loop, the program believes he needs to unlock something, and well, he believes that it will be one lock either on car or car.next and one on previous and previous.next. If this is not sufficient, meaning the sketch is not free, he could give this little bit more freedom, essentially enlarging the space of candidate implementations. Next, the program believed that inside the loop, as you are walking, you need to lock something and unlock something in each step. But what you lock is not given here, and under which condition you lock it is also not given. And these are described with these C macros. I know C macros are not popular, but it communicates the idea. Essentially, the comparison is what? It's either expression with equal or not equal, and the left-hand side is either current or previous, optionally with dot next or null, similarly the right-hand side. And the location is, again, current, previous, or t.prev with dot next. And finally, the programmer doesn't know in which order these things are executed. Of course, if multiple threads go concurrently, the order in which you flip these pointers and acquire the logs is essential, because some orders allow threads to corrupt the behavior. So he tells the synthesizer, well, you know what, find an order of these four statements that give me a correct execution on all possible interleavings of threads. So here is the sketch, and you saw how he obtained it from the sequential program by adding some insight of what the concurrent one could do. So clearly you had to already understand what roughly the algorithm should do, but you didn't have to understand the low-level details. And it doesn't seem like the synthesizer has a lot of freedom here, but this sketch describes about 10 to the 9 different implementations, about 1 billion of them. Now, in addition to this, we need to say what is a correct behavior, and that's given by a sequential version of the program. And so once you give it that, it will synthesize this program. So what it has done, it has figured out what it needs to log in each iteration, under what condition it needs to do it, and figure out the order in which the statements are executed safely. And that's it. So that's essentially the result of the synthesizer that went through these 10 to the 9 alternatives, not one by one. I'll tell you tomorrow how, and picked one that was correct according to reference specification, which was essentially sequential version of the data structure. There are multiple solutions. I don't know how many exactly there are, but clearly there could be versions that are isomorphic just through renaming of variables. Then there are some others that are still correct, but perhaps not as high performance as this one. Perhaps the locking that you obtain will have slightly larger mutual exclusion region. So that's not a problem that we looked at so far. But you can envision generating all possible solutions and then picking, essentially in so-called auto-tuning style, a good one. If there are too many of these solutions, you could put some assertions that will either collapse those isomorphic ones to remove them and so on. Yeah, so we'll mostly focus here on just getting one that is correct. But yeah, there could be multiple, of course. So here we are getting to the language design. The sketch language essentially has just two constructs that enable you synthesis. Here is the specification, which tells you what behavior you want. This one, you just, you know, double the value of x. And here is the sketch, which is a program with holes. And the hole was just one simple construct. It's this double question mark, which the synthesizer completes with a constant. Not an expression, just a constant, in such a way that this sketch, after completed, behaves like foo. So this implements here essentially links this sketch with the specification, which demands that these two functions have identical observable behavior. And after the result, of course, the whole needs to be completed with a constant one, otherwise it would not implement the same behavior. Now, how is this constant sufficient to implement the constructs I showed you in the previous slide, such as choosing expressions and reorder? Well, all these constructs can be easily desugared into this constant hole. effectively they can be implemented as a huge switch statement naively, which depending on the value in the head of the switch chooses the appropriate value. You can do better encoding, but this is one of them. So how is this related to partial programs? Well, we've seen two systems, one ELIPS for synthesis of intelligent agents, and another one for synthesis of, you could say, high performance programs. And both of them can be described as having a synthesizer that receives two things, a partial program that is program parameterized with something that the synthesizer needs to produce, let's call it a completion, and some correctness criterion that describes what is a suitable completion. And then you put these two together, the completion of program, and it's usually a trivial way you obtain the resulting program. In the case of the sketch, well, this is typically a reference implementation, or it could be just assertion sprinkled throughout the sketch. And the sketch is the partial program, there is a set-based synthesizer inside, and the result are the values of those question mark holes. That's it.
Uh-huh. You just subvert what you have, make it fully derived in the program, make it so undisciplined that effectively it selects everything.
That it selects everything, meaning selects from what?
From statements. I mean, for instance,
oh, I see.
In the stream, I can imagine you, your program is an interpreter, and then you have a big statement that you say, Swiss, any of those opcodes.
Yes, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. So effectively, you build the entire program with certs. So I'm trying to see the philosophical distinction that you use.
Yes.
Is there really a philosophical distinction between derivation and selection?
Well, I think, first of all, I think what I understand you're asking, let me clarify this, is you're asking, couldn't you, using the sketch, describe not a particular space of candidate implementations, so these concurrent data structures, most of them are incorrect, but still all of them follow essentially the skeleton of the sequential one. But instead, couldn't use the sketch to describe all possible programs in a given language, right? I think that's the question. And absolutely you could, because that sketch is already a syntactic description of a space of programs. Depending on the value of the hole, it is one program or another, and you can in fact describe a grammar where the hole serves the purpose of choosing which derivation you take from the start non-terminal. So absolutely, the sketch could encode the grammar, and therefore this thing here could describe all possible programs from a given language, and then the reference implementation would play the same purpose, and in principle this could give you holes that turn that grammar into a program. So these holes would effectively, using that grammar, derive that program, right? So first of all, philosophically, is this a derivation? It is a derivation, but not in the semantic sense that you would do in theorem proving, where you use theorems or rewrite rules to obtain always semantically equivalent versions of the program. What you are doing, you are using a grammar derivation. The sketch encodes a grammar of the language, and the holes will tell you, now use a while loop. Now do this in the body of the while loop. Now use this expression. So it is a different derivation. It's a syntactic, and yes, it has been found by the synthesizer, but it is a different derivation rather than the theorem prover semantic derivation. So does that answer the question? So
it's very philosophical. I think Husserl was considering derivation to be optimized set. So he loved examples like taking the little puzzle where you have a wolf and a sheep and some grain. Uh-huh.
Yes.
I mean, I don't see, when I do Sudoku, I don't think of forward thinking as any different than guessing
yes.
and going back, except it's, I know the rules and it's so much more efficient.
Right. So now, in that sense, you understand how using a complete grammar of the language here would use not an efficient derivation sequence, but really naive one. Because when I use a grammar and I derive from it the desired program, as I do the next step of the derivation using that context-free grammar, I have no idea whether that is going to lead to an efficient program or not. the synthesizer effectively, it doesn't do it that way, but effectively needs to go through all programs derived from the grammar and choose a good one. Whereas in these better semantic derivations, such as those done in deductive synthesis, you know what you are doing in each step. Right? In these rewrite systems, you know that the resulting program may be equivalent, semantically equivalent version of the original one, structurally different with different computational characteristics. So yes, there would be derivation here, but it's very different kind of derivation. Now, in terms of whether this would be plausible, could you, instead of putting here a sketch, like the concurrent data structure sketch, which conveys the inside of the programmer, could you just put there the whole language, right? Could you say, consider all programs from a given language? So we did some calculations, and the numbers are pretty staggering. So to derive the data structure, you would need to have about 10 to the 27 or 10 to the 34 or so candidates. So if we were able to test each candidate in one compute cycle, right? So imagine you have 1 gigahertz processor, you take just one cycle to test correctness of the candidate. You would still need 4 billion years to go through that space of candidates to find the correct program. So roughly the age of the universe, even if you can do it in one cycle. Now, that sketch you saw corresponded to about 10 to the 9 candidates. So that's significantly smaller number. So that documents the value of sort of the partial programs for communicating insight. That sketch took some human insight to put together, but it still did not contain the lowest level details, and it shrunk the space from 10 to the 34 to 10 to the 9. And now this is such a big difference that now if you realistically check each program in a second, I think that can be done in a second, now you can get the result in about 100 days. 10 to 100 days you can search the space and get the correct program. Now that's still too slow, but tomorrow I'll show you an algorithm that rather than searching each individual candidate in that space of 10 to the 9 or typically much more than that, we do it in 1 minute. So rather than 10 to 100 days, we do it in a minute by better constraint solving. So this would not be a naive search, but a constraint solving that gets you from 100 days to roughly 1 minute. No, it really checks only the resulting value, typically.
And it means that if I have a reference implementation and I have a sketch that is structurally and totally different from the reference implementation, it works, right?
It works. In fact, the reference implementation could be really slow. Of course, some of them make it a little bit harder to check depending on what your checker is, but usually we only take the resulting value from the reference implementation. But sometimes the reference implementation doesn't need to be a separate program. It could be assertions sprinkled throughout the sketch, which determine your correctness. And then again, it doesn't really matter how you check the property. You can instrument the data structure to carry some history and then check for them. So as long as it is all converted into safety property using assertions, it works. OK, so this is in ALISP. So what's interesting in ALIS is what is the correctness condition, and it is the reward function. So that's essentially the desired thing. It tells you, well, if you play the game like this, you are going to score so much, and that's it. Then there is the partial program, and here are the learned functions that come out, and there is reinforcement learning inside rather than an inductive set solver. Okay, so this brings us to the first problem with this partial program synthesis, and that is that you need to have a specification of correctness. And sometimes it is easy to provide. It is a reference implementation of your sort, reward function for a game, and so on. And sometimes unit tests, so a few input-output pairs are sufficient to constrain the behavior of the program to synthesize what you want. But sometimes even that is difficult to create. Imagine that you have a data structure that you want to implement, and writing a specification may be as difficult as writing the data structure itself. Writing the correct outputs may be equally difficult because you need to manually construct the node somehow, or the assertion that checks correctness is difficult itself. So the next two projects I'll show you will explore how you could do less on the side of what is correct, and hopefully therefore make it more accessible to programmers. You'll think of it as ideas that you can hopefully apply in other settings because they are quite inspiring. So here is a system that we did called Prospector, and the goal here is to make it easier to reuse software. Imagine you have a huge library of classes methods. Think of 100,000 or methods. For example, the Eclipse IDE comes with roughly that number of methods. And here is the problem we ran into. I wanted to prepare a project for the undergraduate compiler class, and I knew that in Eclipse there must be a Java parser because there is a Java AST inside, and so I should be able to just open a Java file, run a parser through it, obtain the AST. It took 4 hours to get that piece of code, about 3 lines you will see in a second, to make it work. The reason was that, I'll show you the reasons. The really bad thing was that I couldn't even do it 4 hours in a row because it was really hurt my head to read the classes and try to put the strings together. So I had to spread it over about 2-3 days before I found the result. A student of mine did it in an hour, but it was still too much. So here is the result. I knew that, well, there is an iFile interface in Eclipse, which hopefully is the handle to my Java file, and I wanted to get an AST node. So this much I knew. And here is the resulting code. And the reason why the productivity was less than line of code per hour was roughly threefold here. The first one is that I expected a certain level of design in the data in the API. I expected there would be one file handle that I will just open and run a parser through it and I'm done, but there are two different file handles, sort of one general and one more specific to Java. Second, there are nice class browsers in Eclipse and you can use them to browse methods, but there are two unknown classes here. Well, the AST eventually I found, but Java Core, it would never cross my mind that I need to look into Java Core. And in fact, other studies have shown that if sort of creators of objects are not in the class of that object, instead they are factory methods somewhere else, programmers become 3 to 8 times less productive. So this is an instance of that. But of course, it's multiplied by other effects that, well, I wanted to use grep to just find a class that returns AST node. And of course, it didn't work because this method, parse compilation unit, doesn't return AST node. It returns some subclass of AST node. So my grep, since it wasn't semantics aware, just didn't find it. So it was hell. And that was a common enough experience that we decided to build some sort of synthesizer for it. We initially thought of it as a Google engine for programmers that will find you such snippets of code as examples, but then we realized we don't need to find examples, we can actually synthesize them. So here is how we do it. So the first observation was that many of these problems that programmers had when using APIs can be described what you could call have one, want one query, which is a query that says, I have a pointer of the following of the given static type, say foo, so that's the H type, the have type, and I want to obtain a pointer to of a particular other type, so that's your want. We want to go from foo to bar, and you have a pointer to foo in some variable, you want to generate code that essentially does, you could say, conversion from foo to bar. Slightly generalized notion of conversion. So the fact that this query described most of these cases was the first enabling step. The second one was that if you want to answer the query, meaning synthesize the code that gets you from H to W, it's enough to generate what we call the jungloid. It's a chain of essentially single parameter calls. So function composition, you could say. Of course, these functions don't need to really be single parameter functions. They could have other parameters, and for the purpose of synthesis, you ignore them. And then once you synthesize the code, you can, so perhaps in the recursive invocation of the synthesis, figure out how you complete the other arguments to that call. But it's enough for the programmer to get this one chain calls as the result of the synthesis. And then the synthesizer, how does it work? The algorithm, and that's the observation 3, is very simple. You build a graph where each node is a class in this API. It's connected with directed edges. If there exists a method that takes you from one class to the next, or instance of that class to the next. And then the jungloid is a path in this graph. And it turns out that the length of the path is a very good heuristic for how likely that jungloid is a suitable answer to the query, what the programmer intended. And there are a few other heuristics, such as don't cross too many packages when you generate the jungloid. But with these three observations, you essentially got a synthesizer. Now, of course, you don't want to ask the programmer to write the query. There is a nice interface that we built for it. And essentially, it piggybacks on this code completion mechanism in Eclipse, which is you put a cursor somewhere and you ask, what code I could write here? And the way it works is that You put the cursor here. So imagine you want to initialize the variable AST, your cursor is here. And the first thing that the tool does, it looks at the type of that variable that you want to initialize, and this is your want type. You look at the variables in scope, you look at their have types, and so now you have two queries, which you don't know what they are as a programmer, but these are sent to the synthesizer. It generates a bunch of jungloids, ranks them according to heuristics, and then displays them like this. Now, this is not the best demonstration, but what it shows is, it shows the candidates here sorted. So here is one call, here is another nested call, and the jungloid here is broken down into two lines. And it seems that they do the same thing because they look the same, but because these are interfaces, there are many implementations with different classes, and these are shown here. And so the programmer now goes through it, and often without looking into the documentation, by just from the names of the functions and names of the classes, he can select the right one. The synthesizer plops it here, renaming the sort of formal arguments or the meta variables with the variables from the file buffer and inserts it there. So the second one, probably the most interesting of all, is work by Tessa Lavon on smart edit. The problem that they saw was that we know that editor macros are extremely useful because they make your task very convenient. For example, if you want to convert a trough bibliography file into a BibTeX bibliography file, it's a thing that's mechanical, but writing a script is painful. Writing editor macros may be a little bit easier, but still something that is not accessible to end users. So their solution was, well, the user demonstrates the steps of the desired macro, and after a few demonstrations, the system learns a macro that is unambiguous. Unambiguous here really means that even though there are still many different macros that are consistent with the demonstrations, all of them would, on the rest of the file, do the same thing. So perhaps you didn't demonstrate enough in general, but you demonstrated enough for this file. And so at that point, you can push the button, and that learn macro or macros, they do the same thing, will process the rest of the file. And there's a solver based on version space algebra that actually keeps track of these alternative macros. So here is an example. You may want to go from this file to that file, and imagine that you put your cursor here, and what happens next? Well, you get the following demonstration. You essentially say, well, you first, so what is a demonstration? It's a sequence of program states, and this is not quite a program, but you can liken that to a program. And the state is the position of the cursor in each step. So you start with the cursor at the beginning of the file. You say the state of the buffer is the particular file. Maybe you put the clipboard in the state as well. And in the second step, you move the cursor into the red dot here, and the buffer and the clipboard don't change. And this is essentially the demonstration that you get. So this is one demonstration. You may get a few of them. Now, what do they do? So this is what they want to synthesize. Out of these demonstrations, they essentially want to say, well, my macro has the following form. The first step is move, and rather than moving to a particular position, the macro, of course, needs to generalize and know how, in any instance of the file, you would move the macro. And the argument here, move to right after the string that starts with person sign A. And this is indeed what they have done in this case. So this is the sort of generalization you want to do from going from demonstrations to macros. So this is how you could actually describe the space of these macro programs that they want to learn in Sketch. They don't use our Sketch language, they use something else, but the idea is essentially the same. The macro looks as follows. They say, well, my macro has some number of steps, and I don't know how many, but the synthesizer needs to figure out how many. In each step, I need to do either a move or insert or cut or copy or I don't know what, and the synthesizer needs to decide which one it is based on the demonstration scene. And for insert, say we need to insert either a given constant string or perhaps there is some other argument that specifies what is inserted, maybe some strings indented by appropriate command. I don't know what the argument was, don't remember. But when you move, there is a location, and the location could be one of some offset, which is number of words from the current position, or a row and column, or some prefix, and so on. And so this essentially, their space of macro programs that they can learn can be described again by a partial program similar to this one. So now, are these two systems, prospectors and smart edit, really instances of partial programs? And well, indeed they are. They have a correctness criterion, they have a partial program, they have a completion, but it's all with a twist. Remember, the goal was somehow to avoid the need to specify what exactly is a correct program, right? In the case of prospector, we didn't know which completion is correct. And in fact, formally stating that I want a program that opens a Java file, parses it, gives me an AST, would be significantly longer than the three lines of code, because you would presumably need to describe Java syntax, describe the meaning of the AST. That would not quite work. Similarly, in smart edit, it would be difficult to describe what does it mean for an editing macro to be correct. It's just easier to write the macro. So these were the two problems attacked in these systems. And how did they solve it? So in prospector, the correctness criterion was this have and want query. It wasn't a complete correctness criterion, but it constrained the correctness in some way. Essentially, it said, I'm interested in programs that accept this type, produce that type. And that was part of the correctness condition. Then there was also a partial program here. Essentially, it was the template of the jungle. It said, well, given an API, my space of programs are all chain calls of the single argument functions over that API. That's essentially partial program describing what programs you care about. Now, what are the other parts of the correctness conditions? Well, the shortest path search, the shortest part of it essentially describes a heuristic that you use for ranking jungloids. So you could say this is number one of the correctness condition. Shortest one is number two that ranks the jungloids appropriately. But then the user needs to step in, and the user explores these ranked jungloids and picks the desired one. So ultimately, the user is the third part of the correctness condition. And that's sort of the beauty of it, that you don't specify correctness up front. You just constrain it enough here and constrain it enough there that the user can usually find it in the top 5 or top 10 elements. And the point is that the selection is easier than a priori specification of the correctness. And that perhaps has ideas in other domains of such synthesis. In smart edit, well, they actually didn't do it the way I'm going to describe. I modified in order to make my point. Their system is slightly different, but similarly, they have the macro template, which you could think of partial program or a sketch for the class of programs. They have demonstrations, which are the concrete runs of the user demonstrating what it should do. And then implicitly, you get a set of macro parameters on the output. These are all possible completions of the partial program still consistent with the demonstrations. You add one more demonstration, the set shrinks. So when you plug this in here, you get not one macro, but you get multiple, one for each completion. And what you do, you run that macro on input file, and you look at what is the resulting file. If it is the same for each of these macros, you are done, because now you have learned these unambiguous macros. If it is not enough, because the processed result can be different for some macros, you go here and you tell the user, demonstrate some more. And that's the loop that leads to essentially the resulting program, which is the desired macro, and it is done by checking whether all macros consistent with current demonstration have the same effect. If not, you iterate. So compare those two systems, which have sort of a weaker notion of correctness. Either the user selects and says OK, or it does the same effect on a file. What do you do in Sketch? You have a reference implementation which fully describes the behavior, and then you get the holes on the output. Clearly, there is a burden in writing this, but the benefit is that you can get a program that is sort of general purpose rather than an API call or a macro for editing. So this is how we solve the problem of where the correctness condition comes from. So you could have a reference implementation, or at the end a correctness check, which just checks if the result is correct. This gives you all input-output pairs. You could do unit testing and just get some input-output pairs. In prospector, you approximate. You say, well, for now I'm enough that it matches the types of the query. In smart edit, you tell the user that valid completions still diverge on some input, and the user gives you more demonstrations. The second problem with partial programs, and that one is probably harder to solve, but I'll show you a potential solution, is that sometimes when the programmer is programming, his early insight is still too fuzzy to express as a program. So you need to already understand the problem well enough to write a program that has holes to be completed. Sometimes you are far from there. So wouldn't it be nice if we could get a demonstration from someone of the program we want to write. So imagine I give you an assignment as a professor and you come to me and say, I have no clue, or I have some clue, but could you give me a hint? And if the hint could show the steps of the algorithm on some input, and maybe such demonstrations on several inputs, that you would be left with the task of observing what the hint, the execution shows, and generalizing from those into the algorithm that actually does the computation. But of course, sometimes there is no one to give you that demonstration. In the case of Smart Edit, it was the user who demonstrated what the macro did, and that was nice. But in general, there is no one to give the demonstration. So wouldn't it be nice if there was an oracle that did the demonstration for us? So I'll show you now how you can get such a demonstration by the oracle in practice. So here is the idea. Imagine that you want to do a program that reverses a linked list. It's a simple, naive problem, but demonstrates the idea quite well. So we have a list, and we want to get from this list to this list. And this already poses a question. Do you walk the list from the beginning to the end, or somehow you walk it backwards, and this is how you reverse the list? So already there are choices that you need to think about when implementing it. So we ask the oracle how to do it. The oracle shows us, well, you flip this pointer first, then you add this pointer, and that shows you the demonstration. So again, the oracle says, well, zero out this pointer, then add, flip this pointer from 2 to 3 to 2 to 1, and now connect 3 to 2. And that's a demonstration of how the oracle reversed the list. Now all we need to do is think about how he did it. Oh, he went left to right, and now we need to generalize from what we saw to a program that does it. So these hints might, in general, be useful in tricky programs. So once he shows us, we can mimic it with deterministic execution. But of course, the problem is we need to tell the oracle what sort of demonstration we want. Again, we need some sort of prescription to tell the oracle, give us a demonstration of what. And for that, again, we go to the idea of partial programs. And we turn the idea a little bit around and say, well, if we tell the oracle what we want to do, so in the case of reversing linked list, we say what it means that the linked list is correctly reversed. That check is not too difficult to write. And we write such a partial program whose completion is not going to be the desired program, but the completion of the partial program will be the demonstration that we want. So we write a partial program that is sort of a recipe for the oracle to show us how to do it. So how do you do such a recipe for the oracle? So we introduce a new kind of operator called a choice operator. And it's, what does it return? The oracle, which executes the choice operator, needs to return such a value that the program can complete without failing an assertion. So in this case, the oracle needs to return such a value x, such that when you apply foo on it, the y is prime. So essentially, the oracle needs to look into the future of the execution and pick the right value. So it has this oracle look ahead, which essentially allows you to figure out what the steps of the algorithm are. Now, how do you implement it? Of course, you can implement it with backtracking, which is what Floyd proposed many years ago. Essentially, you try one value, you continue, if you crash, you backtrack and try a new one. Or you can do a little bit better in terms of scalability, in fact, significantly better, and turn the program into a logical formula and look for correct values of the oracle. So let me show you how you implement this oracle that gives you a demonstration of the linked list reversal. So you write this essentially simple program. It's a function that accepts a list and wants to reverse it. At the end, there is a correctness condition which checks that the reverse list is a reversal of that input list. So this is what the oracle checks against. And now look what happens in the loop. So this oracular value always returns a Boolean. So essentially, it controls how many iterations of the loop you need. Now, these two evaluate two pointers to nodes already available in the program. So in each step of the iteration, the oracle chooses one node here, whose next field is going to be overwritten, and it chooses a pointer value that will be written into this next field. And in the end, the head of the list is going to be selected as well. And it does it in such a way that this is satisfied. So the of course, some backtracking or solving going on underneath, but you can really think of it as the oracle always knows what to do. if, as of course, assuming it is possible to find such angelic values. This is called angelic program because essentially these constructs here are non-deterministic constructs. They can pick any value, but they do it angelically, cooperatively with you to execute the program without failing an assertion, rather than demonically to show that whether there is a value that makes the program. And so essentially the result of this execution of the program is a sequence of values which the programmer can output. And now you can do it in various ways. We have a user interface that shows you the values, but this is what you observe, learn from the oracle, and then you can start refining the program by making the execution a little bit less non-deterministic, essentially replacing the angels with deterministic implementations which actually compute what the angel somehow guessed. So you could, as the first step, figure out what is the condition for when you should iterate. Next step, perhaps you figure out what is how you compute the value that you are reversing, perhaps implement the code that walks the list, and so on. And in each step, if there still exists an execution that essentially the oracle can find, then there is, since the oracle can complete the program, there is hope that you still can by fleshing the program out. If not even the oracle can complete the program, what do you know? You know that you're on a wrong path in this implementation. You better backtrack and rethink how you do it. So the idea is, if the oracle cannot find the suitable execution, you are stuck. If he can, then he gives you a demonstration of how the steps should go. You can observe them and start implementing his magical steps. So to conclude the discussion of partial programs, it's interesting to consider whether there are other ways to turn things around. So what we've seen is that, well, partial programming is you get a partial program correctness condition, you get a completion, and that together gives you the program. The second version was that we got a partial program that has these angelic constructs in it whose result was a demonstration of the execution. But essentially the idea is the same. It would be interesting whether you can flip it in such a way that, well, what comes in is a demonstration as a way of essentially constraining what it means to be correct. And out comes a partial program and a completion. So essentially, rather than going from partial program to a complete program, we take demonstrations and try to decompose them into a partial program from which one could synthesize these completions. And why could that be useful? I don't know, but here is one idea. Apparently, when people program in companies that are sensitive about stealing intellectual property and licenses, there's the boundary of how much code you can copy before you consider to have plagiarized, essentially, licensed code is sort of fuzzy. Well, wouldn't it be nice if you just use demonstrations of those licensed code, generate a partial program, and then claim, well, all the programs that we use in our code were synthesized by our tool. Of course, the tool learned from demonstrations of the licensed code, but you are now at least one step removed from the original code. So here the synthesizer would essentially create the partial program from which you then synthesize your code. So that's just the food for thought. So what have we done here? We say that partial programs indeed can in several domains communicate programmer insight. If there is a suitable synthesis algorithm that sort of completes the partial program providing the mechanics. There are some key challenges such as what is the correctness condition, the desired behavior, and how to capture early insight, you know, before we can write a partial program. Can the oracle help? There may be other ideas further. And it's also interesting to consider whether this sort of few systems, the five systems I showed you, could you generalize to other problems, sort of end-user programming, such as mashups, API-level coding that goes beyond the jungloids that I showed you. Those problems can, too, perhaps be decomposed into essentially a partial program, suitable algorithm, completion, and some correctness condition. How to do it, we don't know, but that's the opportunity here. So I think I'll stop here with the slides and would like to open the floor for questions since we have maybe 7 more minutes.
In the case of the linked list that you were removing one element from, I couldn't understand how do you make sure that the program generated by your algorithm is doing the same thing that the reference implementation is doing. How do you do this refinement here?
So you're talking about the concurrent data structure?
Because there was no specification. There. Right. You had the secure.one and the other program.
Right, so I didn't show you the specification. But the specification would essentially do the okay, so how would the specification look like? You write yourself essentially a driver, okay, which starts multiple threads, and each of these threads performs a sequence of inserts and removes, okay? And you execute the driver in two different environments. One of them is with the concurrent data structure, which has this fine-grained locking, executes the sketch effectively, and another one which executes, you could say, a sequential version of the data structure. That could be one that is fully locked, okay? And now you consider the fully locked implementation, which is clearly not as high performance as the one that is finally fine-grained locked, that's your reference standard. And now what does the driver do? At the end of the execution of those threads, you check that the set contains the same elements in both cases. In the case that use the sort of the reference implementation that you know is correct, the one that locked the whole thing and therefore serialized those threads, and that the set produced by that implementation is the same as the set produced by the concurrent implementation.
But how many execution traces do you want to investigate? There is no guarantee that you run it for many times. And
right. I see. So now this boils down to how strong your checker is. So in general, so let me tell you first what we have done. So we have used the spin model checker to explore the execution on a bounded number of threads and the bounded number of operations. So we use probably 4 or 5 threads, some maybe sequences of up to 5 or 6 operations performed by each thread. And on that space of executions, we did the comparison. So effectively, it was the classical bounded model checking. The assumption is that if you don't find a bug in this space, there is no bug and the execution is correct. And it has the same limitations of, you know, using bounded model checking for verification. There could be, in principle, an execution that is longer on which this problem appears. Now, there exist stronger checkers, in fact, verifiers for some of these data structures, and you could plug them in instead of the weaker one that we had and do a stronger check. But probably a better solution is to, rather than put them into our synthesizer, whose structure I'll show you tomorrow, once you synthesize the stuff with our synthesizer, you could then sort of post-mortem check the correctness of the synthesized code with the stronger verifier. So perhaps you want to use a manual interactive theorem prover, you put in invariants. So the idea would be that you would use our system for performance exploration when you quickly need to generate multiple variants. Once you find one that performs up to your performance specifications, you then go and double check its correctness on a stronger check than what we give you. But yes, of course, there are limitations to the checker that sits inside our loop. Yeah. Please. Yes, it is. Yes.
But it's just like 75.
I missed that because of the noise. Can you repeat the last one?
It's semi-definable.
Semi-definable.
Indecidable. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So in general, the checking problem is undecidable. So the checker typically performs some bounded version of the check. I'll show you for some domains tomorrow how we can do a check by semantic reduction on all possible inputs. But of course, on a general program, yes, how to do it is undecidable. You can put in some extra human effort in putting invariants. So what our system typically does is that it does the check on some space of inputs. You say, let's do the check on all linked lists of up to size 5. And that's it. If it turns out that the program is incorrect on larger inputs, then you are in trouble. But as I said, you can then do the sort of extra work of manual verification after the fact. And that's, of course, a limitation of verification, as we know. So to put a little bit more positive light on it, the correctness that we guarantee for you is as strong as the verification technology out there. If you give us a better verifier, then we can plug it in and use a stronger verifier to do the synthesis. Currently, it stops at the first result. usually that's not a problem, because usually the sketch is constrained sufficiently that all correct solutions are essentially isomorphic to each other. But that's not always the case. Sometimes we are surprised and you write a sketch whose completion is a program that doesn't do what you want. So at least in current systems, we do need to look at the program and see what was synthesized, absolutely. We are now working on getting multiple solutions and testing their performance and so on. But currently it stops at the first one. You mean what are the values that the synthesizer produces for the question marks? So the question mark truly is just a constant. It could be a Boolean constant, could be an integer, could be some essentially a sequence or a list of such values. For example, you can initialize a table with values that come from a question mark. So in crypto algorithms, often it's a question of synthesizing suitable lookup values that together with some expression will do the desired permutation. So the holes could initialize those tables. When you want to do something like reordering statements, you need to write a high-level constructs that you desugar into these holes, for example, using a switch. Now, how to do it is usually trivial. How to do it in such a way that the set solver scales well takes a little bit of experimentation and experience. But semantically, it's just desugaring. Please. Which happens, yes, absolutely.
Okay. Given that you don't really want to put in a construct in there that says fill in this arbitrary code, except that's just going to blow off, what direction do you head in that?
Okay, so that actually, you could say, this is a problem of debugging sketches, right? That sometimes you write a sketch that has a bug itself because you were not able to factor out all possible bugs into those holes, you could say. And that happens now and then. And in fact, I could say that that was the biggest usability obstacle with sketching, that you could write sketch that really communicate your insight, but there was a bug somewhere in it. And unlike a regular program, which you can run on an input and observe a sequence of states and realize, oh, I screwed up here, you cannot, because sketch corresponds to bazillions of programs. So which one do you run? So the angelic programming I showed you turned out to be an answer to the debugging of sketches. That may be surprising, but this is how we came up with the idea that essentially, I wrote a program that I'll show you on Saturday that was a beautiful sketch for a problem of a particular sorting problem posed by Dijkstra, but there was a bug somewhere and I didn't know where. And I realized that if only I had a demonstration of what the program should do step by step, then I can check individual steps in the sketch and say, can this statement execute the transition from this state to that state? So rather than thinking globally, I can now restrict my thinking locally, and it is much easier. But of course, who gives me such demonstration? I was thinking of smart edit, where you may also need to debug that partial program, but you have user demonstrations, and you can check it locally. And that's what brought up the idea of the angel, that I can use the angel to give me these demonstrations, and now I sketch not the entire program, but I sketch these individual transitions. Furthermore, I can do it in this gradual fashion that I start with the angelic program, and I turn these bang-bang operators, the choices, into question marks, and as soon as that program breaks, meaning not even the angel can complete it, I know, oh, now I screwed up. So it's not all at once, but it's more like real programming where you do things interactively, hopefully more. So that's the answer to dealing with buggy sketches, that you actually develop the sketch going from the angel to the program with question marks, which is correct.
So would you categorize sketches that simply don't have enough flexibility within them using this sort of a debugging system? I mean, say for example, in the first example you gave with the removing an element from the list, if you've forgotten to put the statements about locks and unlocks in them, would you recommend this sort of angelic programming for debugging that, or would you try some other approach?
I would probably use the angelic debugging. We don't have enough experience with it yet, but this seems to be the more promising thing, that you start with the angel who will just say, well, you ask first the angel to order the statements in a suitable way. Now you observe how he does it. And then you constrain him more and more until perhaps there is only one way how he can do it. But you constrain him declaratively with assertions, not prescriptively on how actually he needs to do it. Once he gives you a demonstration, perhaps there is only one, you see, oh, this is how he does it. And now you start flashing in the statement, so, oh, okay, so here I need to log something. And you put in now a log, which still can have question marks in it, but now you are thinking as a programmer of a single step. So this is, I think, the long-term evolutions. There are other ways, by the way, how you could debug sketches. After all, the sketch is translated to a Boolean formula that is not satisfiable. You could ask for the smallest subset of the formula that shows why it's not satisfiable.
Yeah. Last question. Once you get into this sort of debugging and iterative process, the execution time starts to become an issue. You mentioned you've got this down for the example program you gave down to about a minute. Is that a minute that with another 3 months of work you could get it down to a second, or a minute that it's going to take some revolution of mathematics to bring down to a second?
It could be down significantly more. But first of all, let me say that many of the problems we look at are just a few seconds. They truly are interactive. Okay. The concurrent one is really hard because there you need to deal with all possible interleavings of these threads, which is what makes it really slow. But in the sequential case, the performance often is interactive. Now, there are some hard crypto programs that take 20 minutes to synthesize, but it's still better than writing an optimizing compiler that will generate the code. So, yeah, I'd say we didn't look enough into how the set solver can be given heuristics by propagating from high level to be even faster, but there is room for improvement. So, yeah, I think that interactive is our goal and in many cases possible.
We should stop here.
Yes, we should.
We'll have every brief break.
Thank you.